partisan divide over raising the debt ceiling. Senate Republicans reject redistricting bill changes, plus banning COVID-19 vaccine mandates, and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending October 1st, 2021.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller, a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, both of Indiana's U.S. senators said they will vote no on raising the national debt ceiling. WFIU-WTIU's Adam Pinsker reports.
The Biden administration says the government could default on its bills if the debt ceiling isn't raised. Congress raised the debt ceiling three times while President Trump was in office, but Democrats apparently will have to go it alone this time. Senator Mike Braun doesn't expect a single Republican to vote in favor of it.
If we keep endorsing lifting debt ceilings, continuing resolutions, that's a disservice to the American public, not an aid.
Senator Braun says the federal government needs to create a more dedicated funding source to offset its debt, such as an increase in the federal gas tax. Senator Todd Young says he's voting no because Republicans don't have a say in the spending increases being proposed by the Biden administration.
Should Indiana's U.S. senators vote against the debt ceiling increase? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney. Republican Joey Fox. John Schwannis, host of Indiana Lawmakers. And Nikki Kelly, Statehouse reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting Statehouse reporter Brandon Smith. Ann Delaney, does Senator Braun have a good point?
You know, there's hypocrisy and there's hypocrisy. Senator Braun and Senator Young had no problem lifting the debt ceiling when Donald Trump wanted to cut the taxes on corporations and rich people. They were all for it then, all for it. So, no, he doesn't have a point. I mean, it would be nice if there was some Republican participation in this process, but they are so driven by the radical right that controls their party that they don't want to compromise. I mean, you have Republican after Republican saying that the infrastructure bill that's also before the Congress now is a good bill, but they can't vote for it because they're worried about the next bill. Whereas, you know, it goes on and on and on. It's all partisan politics. It has nothing to do with fiscal policy at all. And it's situational in the extreme. And they should be embarrassed, both of them, by their position.
Joey Fox, when you're in the minority, we often see lawmakers take votes on bills because they can, because they know they will ultimately pass. Is this a case where they want to make a statement and they're right to do it?
Well, of course you're right to make a statement about the continuing debt, continuing spending in the United States. And that's been true under Democrat and Republican administrations, unfortunately, for a long time. I think, though, what Ann is talking about on the support for the bipartisan infrastructure bill, where there is support for new spending, she's absolutely right that Republicans are worried about what comes next, because it's a $3 trillion plus in new spending when we clearly can't even afford the spending we've already approved, which
right.
is why
so
we have to raise the debt
vote
ceiling.
For that, but vote cool. for the bipartisan spending bill that does infrastructure, which we all recognize is needed. Okay? Do that.
Because the woke progressive left of the Democratic Party is hooking it on immediately and ensuring that the Speaker in the House won't allow that vote unless they also have this $3.5 trillion boondoggle. We clearly can't afford the debt we already have. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here talking about raising the debt ceiling.
It's an excuse. We're
Nikki,
talking about raising the debt ceiling because of the Trump tax cuts.
Nikki Kelly, I want to.
Oh, that's ridiculous. Hold on. Hey, Brandon, that's a ridiculous point. Tax cuts let people's own money stay in their pockets. It's not new spending.
Oh, yeah.
Nikki
right.
Kelly, I want to ask you about how the public views this, because we just heard kind of like a microcosm of how complicated this issue has become. It's not just about the debt ceiling. It's not just about funding the government. It's also about the infrastructure bill, which has been tied to the overall spending bill. How is the average person supposed to make sense of any of this?
I can't even make sense any of it, and I follow it on a daily basis. When they tie things together like this, I think it hurts the general faith in government that people have, because, and whether that's on the state level, national level, Republican, Democrats, I think they want to see up and down votes on the policy in front of them and not tie everything together. Now, on the debt ceiling issue, I think it's pretty normal for the minority party not to support debt ceiling increases. We've seen it under both sides. And so I think the Republicans will probably stick to their guns. And I believe their supporters, their constituents are fine with that.
And then, John Schwanis, let me ask you, do you think that the average American should care about the debt ceiling vote?
Absolutely. A failure to pay attention or care about it invites peril, I think, for those individuals who choose to bury their head in the proverbial sand. You know, I think we can all be concerned about deficit spending, and we can all bemoan the fact that presidents of both parties, administrations, in partnership with Congress, when it's been controlled by Democrats, when it's been controlled by Republicans, have largely accelerated spending, with a few exceptions, basically for a generation or more. And we can all say that's not a good thing. It would be great if we had balanced books. I'm right there with you. But tanking the economy is probably not the best way to achieve that. And the reason that average Hoosiers and everyone else in the country should be concerned is if you have any investments, say, through your work in 401k plans or some other sort of retirement plan, or have any other investments in the stock markets or securities of any kind, basically you would be really rolling the dice and this isn't my opinion. You can ask Janet Yellen, you can ask the chairman of the Federal Reserve, who, by the way, was an appointee of Donald Trump, and his warning that this would be calamitous if the debt ceiling were not raised. So there are a lot of better minds, fiscal minds in mind, saying this is a big problem and you don't want to toy with it for political reasons.
All right. Well, time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Icemiller email and text alerts. This week's question is a version of what I just asked John. Do most Americans care about the national debt ceiling? A, yes, or B, no. Last week's question, should Governor Holcomb use unspent federal coronavirus relief fund dollars to increase traffic safety enforcement, as some House Democrats are proposing? Just 33% of you say he should, 67% say no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, Indiana Senate Republicans rejected all proposed changes to their redistricting map Thursday that had been prompted by public concerns. Amendments offered by Democrats would have kept major Indiana cities more whole in the Senate map. Evansville would have been its own district under the Democrats' proposals rather than split in half. West Lafayette and Lafayette would have been kept together rather than separated into two largely rural districts. A sliver of a predominantly rural district would have been removed from Marion County, and Fort Wayne, currently splintered into four Senate districts, would have been largely contained in just two. Republican Senator Eric Cook, debating that last proposal, objected to reducing the number of lawmakers representing the city.
Why would you want to reduce the influence of the city of Fort Wayne in the Indiana Senate?
But Democratic Senator Greg Taylor says it's Republicans who do that by including urban voters in largely rural districts that stretch multiple counties away.
You kept the South Side and the people of Fort Wayne from having a voice in this legislative body for things that they think are better for them, their families, their loved ones. And that's not right.
All those Democratic proposals were rejected along party lines. Joey Fox, House Republicans were responsive to some of the concerns brought by the public in the committee hearings over the last couple of weeks. Why weren't Senate Republicans?
Man, it's great to be a Democrat right now debating redistricting in Indiana. You get two bases. You get compactness and you get competitiveness. And you're going to get one of the two. And if you don't get one, you just run to the other base and say the whole process is still unfair. The Senate Republicans and the House Republicans have put forward maps that are more compact. They reduce the splits in cities, towns, townships, school districts, et cetera, across the state. And not one Democrat seemed to be able to answer Senator Cook's question as to why they would want one person representing Fort Wayne instead of instead of four. Marion County, the state's largest city, our capital, has 10, will have 10 senators under these maps. Isn't it fair that Fort Wayne has four? I just don't buy these arguments. The Democrats are going to be upset with these maps no matter what they look like.
To that point, yeah. Ann, is Joey right? I mean, Democrats were going to find something that they were unhappy about no matter what changes or not Republicans made.
It's not simply Democrats. You had nonpartisan groups talking about how gerrymandered these districts were. And what they're talking about here.
Nonpartisan, please.
In Fort Wayne, in particular, they have no senator. What they've done is dilute the Democratic vote that is Fort Wayne, and they put it out into rural counties far removed with completely different interests than Fort Wayne. And so what you get is the same kind of thing we've seen in Marion County here. We had that legislation in, 2012 to start charter schools on IPS. Nobody who represents IPS, no senator and no representative voted in favor of that. And yet it was passed. It was passed by those same rural districts. This isn't about compactness, and this isn't about fairness. This is about keeping the supermajority for the Republicans in the Senate. That's why Evansville is split, West Lafayette and Lafayette are split, and that's why they carved up Fort Wayne, and that's why you have a rural area in Marion County. It's all about trying to maximize their number in the legislature. And the problem with that is you don't have competitiveness. And, of course, as Senator Cook said, they don't even care about competitiveness. They don't. So that was actually a truthful statement on his part in large contrast. But what happens
is... Hold on. Joey, I do want to ask you this, which is the House Republican map, if you look at it based on looking at the last presidential results, for instance, would actually lose one, maybe two, or even more House Republican-held seats, the way they've redrawn things to make them more compact and keep communities together. But the Senate Republican map, which is already, as we currently sit, 39-11 for Republicans, would actually go up for Republicans to maybe even 40 or 41. Does that seem representative of Indiana?
No.
I think that the maps follow everything that they're required to do. Democrats are going to be upset regardless. And I hate to break this to Ann, but I can't find a way to draw a Senate map that makes Democrats competitive in this state. It's a supermajority state when you're drawing a Senate map. I'm sorry.
I'm not asking it to be 50-50. What I'm asking it to do is to have actual communities of interest other than the Senate supermajority represented. Two districts.
The Democrat proposals.
One in West
the Democrat Lafayette. Proposals would have carved Evansville all the way out of the middle and built a horseshoe around it. Which, yeah. If the Republicans built horseshoe-shaped districts, so you would be screaming on this show about gerrymandering.
That's what you're saying.
I want to ask Nikki. There was a debate in the Senate yesterday between Senator Cook and predominantly Senator Taylor about what it really means to have a voice in the Senate that I thought was really interesting, which was, it was Senate Democrats and Senate Republicans saying, the Republicans saying, well, we're giving Fort Wayne, for instance, more senators and therefore more of a voice, while Senate Democrats were saying, you're not actually giving the people of Fort Wayne more of a voice because you're spreading those districts into counties away. Do you think one side has a better argument?
Look, I don't know, but I think what is interesting is the House Republican map made Fort Wayne more compact. And that was a good thing that people praised in Fort Wayne, because that meant they would have more representation of people who actually live in Fort Wayne versus just representing a tiny part and they live out in a county, nearby. Whereas the Senate took the exact opposite, which was they're saying they're giving more representation, but that fractures them out. So someone has to be wrong, right? I mean, they can't have both ways where one is making them more compact and that's an improvement. One is making them less compact and they're saying that's an improvement. So, I mean, the people I'm hearing from are upset because they feel like, yes, maybe part of the city of Fort Wayne will be, quote, represented by another person. But if 90% of that person's district is outside of Allen County, then, how much attention are they really going to get?
John Schwanes, to that point, what does it really mean to have a voice or representation in the Indiana General Assembly?
Well, I'll say what it's not, and I don't think it's necessarily determined by the number of representatives or number of senators whose districts happen to intersect a given, say, urban area or any kind of population concentration that you don't want to separate. I could draw a map, I think. You know, there was reference Joey made to 10, Indianapolis having 10 seats under the map. I could probably come up, now it would violate the whole notion of compactness and not dividing things, but anybody could come up with a map where all 10 Indianapolis seats, quote unquote, are drawn in a way that each, the Indianapolis residents in that district are outnumbered by, again, these would be crazy looking maps, but you could basically assure that the so-called 10 seats for Indianapolis voted for Indianapolis's interests 0% of the time.
But John, if realistically, you were pretty artful this is what I'm saying.
I don't think numbers alone tell the story.
You could draw Indianapolis to look like a pizza, so that just enough of the Marion County, which theoretically is going to be more Democratic, would outweigh, so that you would have a bunch of districts kind of circling around from Monument Circle that would be closer to 45-55 splits. In which case, we'd be here with the Democrats screaming about gerrymandering, and then things wouldn't be.
Well, that's because we're talking about, you mentioned the compactness and competitiveness. Let's not forget the two longer standing terms that are often associated with map drawing, and that's packing and cracking. And we don't have time to get into what those terms mean, but people can go look them up. And that's what we have an example of here. That's why you don't have Indianapolis as a pizza, because you also have some packing going on here to try to make sure that the Democrat votes are isolated in those areas.
Let's have competitive districts, or let's not. What do we want here?
That's not from the Indiana Senate.
Let's move on to the next topic. The Indiana House recently dismissed an attempt by one lawmaker to ban any COVID-19 vaccine mandates in the state by anyone. But that likely won't be the last time the issue comes up in the General Assembly. Republican Representative John Jacob tried to introduce an amendment to the redistricting bill that would bar anyone from imposing a COVID-19 vaccine mandate that includes negative consequences, such as being fired, fined, or banned from a facility. The House refused to consider it. The amendment violated House rules, so there wasn't even a vote. But after the House floor session, when Republican Speaker Todd Houston was asked whether he supports the idea, he said he struggles with it.
But I know that it's going to be a discussion that's taking place right now across members of our caucus. I'm sure that'll be a discussion over the next couple months.
Houston has said repeatedly that lawmakers' current work at the State House is solely on redistricting, so any legislative action on vaccine mandate bans shouldn't come until next session. Nikki Kelly, do you think the General Assembly will ban COVID vaccine mandates next session?
I don't know if it'll get all the way through, but there is clearly a core conservative group who will push that hard. You know, I think there will be hearings, there will be bills, and, you know, I would say it's a toss-up right now whether it would happen. It's quite a tightrope, though, for Republicans, because in general, they sort of stand for the ideals of staying out of private-run business, right? But this would tell what a private-run business is or isn't allowed to do with their employees. So it will be an interesting discussion for sure.
John, I'm not going to ask you whether or not you think they will, but I will ask you, by the time they get to considering a bill and even passing a bill like this, it will be months from now, presuming that they actually do it next session. It'll be January, February, or March of next year. So do you think that helps folks who don't want to see this kind of legislation, because they will have been in place longer, there will be less perhaps consternation the longer that these are in place? Do you think there's anything to that?
I do think that's the case. I mean, people will become more accustomed to them. Business will have largely bought into them. Government at various levels, from local to federal, will have bought into them. And they will have produced results. We already are seeing results which are traceable in part to mandates. Some of the data suggests, let's look at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. They're actually projecting decrease And that's a word we don't often associate with COVID-19, decreases in new case diagnoses and in hospitalizations and, of course, deaths. That's all good. So several things. Yes, people might get used to these and see it's not the end of the world. Two, they may see, oh, they're working and we don't have as many people dying or as many people getting sick. And if that's the case, given the short attention span of American electorate and American governance, there'll be other crises or other red herring that we can attack by that point if COVID-19 is, we all hope, off the plate by then.
Joey Fox, to Nikki's point, this seems to put Republicans in a bit of an interesting spot philosophically. Do you think that the Indiana General Assembly should ban private companies from imposing these sorts of mandates?
I don't. First of all, everybody should get vaccinated. It's safe, effective, it works. You should do it if you haven't already. Second, I'm not sure the way you phrased the first question here, Brandon, I'm not sure that the speaker said he was unsure. I think he was saying the caucus had differences of opinion and wasn't sure. Third, I think what you're seeing within the caucus are groups of people that kind of tilt more either towards the rights of private businesses and the rights of individuals. And, you know, as you can probably tell, where I personally come down on that issue, I think that's the ideological conversation that you're going to see happen, is whose rights kind of trump whom. Is it going to be the right of the private businesses to say you can or can't, or is the ultimate right there at the individual level? I think we kind of know where this is going to come out, but I think that's the fight they're going to have inside the caucus.
Yeah. To be fair, I did ask Houston, it was in response to my question. I asked him if he was, how he personally felt about the idea of banning private companies from imposing these mandates, and he said, I struggle with it. But Anne, I do want to ask. No, that's fine. I want to ask you, do you think the General Assembly is going to go through and ban these mandates?
I hope not. You know, what's happening, what I'm hearing from a lot of people is, you know, I got the vaccine and what's the matter with these people? I'm sick of hearing about these people. I'm sick of these people who won't spend $20 to get a vaccine, which the government pays for, but come in and want the antibodies delivered to them when they get sick at a cost of $2,100 a person. I think those conversations are beginning to occur and there's going to be pushback. And the other thing is, I don't know what constitutional authority they have to tell people that they can't make certain parameters about employment. I mean, there are certain general statutes, and if, you know, if it's a health emergency or something along those lines, problems with, you know, or an anti-mandate for vaccines to an employer, I don't understand how they could pass that constitutionally. Because you know what? I have employees, and I mandated it, and they all got it. Okay, and they all have the sense to know that it's the right thing to do for themselves and their coworkers and their families. And, you know, frankly, I'm getting a little tired of listening to that other group out there that talk about their rights. They don't have the right to infect other people, nor do they have the right to blow up everyone's health care costs because they're hospitalized for months because they didn't have the sense to get vaccinated.
Well, Anne, I guess I want to know why you hate freedom so much. Moving on, an unknown rust-colored substance from the U.S. steel plant in Portage was found leaking into a Lake Michigan tributary this week. State and federal environmental agencies are working with U.S. Steel to investigate the cause of the leak. But as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Thiel reports, this comes just weeks after U.S. Steel agreed to pay for a massive chemical spill at the plant 4 years ago.
In 2017, U.S. Steel's Portage facility spilled 300 pounds of the cancer-causing chemical hexavalent chromium into the Burns waterway. Since then, the plant has had at least seven other water violations. Earlier this month, the company agreed to pay more than $1 million for the 2017 spill. Portage City Council President Colin Zilley says any leak or spill along the lake threatens residents' drinking water and their livelihoods.
It's very frustrating that this continually happens, and our hands as a city are tied.
Zilley says only the Environmental Protection Agency and the Indiana Department of Environmental Management can make sure U.S. Steel complies with its permit, unless the city takes the company to court.
All right, John Shaughness, you're going to have the last word of the episode here. Does more need to be done with U.S. Steel quickly?
It seems so. I'm not an expert on the subject, but if there's a recurrence of problems, common sense would suggest that something else needs to happen to step up enforcement.
I suppose the question then becomes, who's going to do it? Is it the Biden administration and the EPA, or is it the state and IDEM? And if I were
Chances are it would be the first as opposed to the latter.
Yeah, that's right. All right, well, that is Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Joey Fox, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.